We've got Johnny, aka Brandmaster Flash Prest, in the house. Johnny, say hello to the people.
Hello, people.
Succinct, concise, just like this podcast isn't. Beautiful.
Hi, I'm Steve Rick.
And I'm Tim Elliott.
And welcome to the RE of Marketing podcast.
A podcast where we rethink, replay, and remark on all good things to do with branding and marketing.
Hello, Timothy.
Hello.
Back again, season back three. Again. Yeah. We're not doing numbers now, are we?
Not doing numbers now, but we're continuing the form and having another. There's somebody else here. I don't know. The podcast people can't see, but we can see. We've got another co-host. We've got Johnny, aka Brandmaster Flash Prest, in the house. Johnny, say hello to the people.
Hello, people.
Succinct, concise, just like this podcast isn't. Beautiful.
And he's also got a proper podcast name in Brandmaster Flash.
Oh, just... thank you. All right.
It's the one for an MC. To have a mic in, it sounds ideal to have a mic in front of you, doesn't it? But Johnny, you may recognise from a chat with me on our bonus episodes, The Rebytes, that he's done a couple of parts on that, which were lovely to have him on. And we enjoyed it so much, and we enjoy Johnny so much that we invited him back on full time for about an hour.
Yeah, which, in the payroll.
I thought I was going to put you on PAYE then, full time on the podcast.
Yeah. No, but like it'll last. The contract's at max hour and a half, I reckon.
Yeah. And so then, 0 hour. We'll get to a certain stage and then we'll let you know how much we're going to give you.
Yeah. Okay. I'll send the invoice in. Don't worry.
It's value attributed. But Johnny's in house. Johnny, for those people who haven't listened to The Rebytes or have not heard of you or what you do, give them a bit of an overview, a bit of a backstory of who you are, what you do, etc.
Yeah, okay. So I'm Johnny Prest, and aka Brandmaster Flash. So my daytime job, I always say it like this, it's boring now. My daytime job is I'm a creative director at Seed. So I manage the creative teams and, I pitch to the clients and just kind of do all the creative and make cool stuff. Within that, one of my roles is brand strategy, and it's kind of growing and growing. It turned from a hobby and from an interest to a hobby, and now it's kind of fully part of my job. And that brand strategy is kind of developed, and I've created my own online platform, my own channel, and that's Brandmaster Flash. And that's kind of my output and my platform to talk about all things brand.
That's good. So that's what the loose topic for today is, right? I think we enjoy your content, don't we, Steve? We view them. We view them, and you as a practical day-to-day creative marketer who runs an agency and has a real job in the trade, unlike me and unlike Steve maybe, who are hosting the podcast, we thought we'd get you on, mate, and shed some light into the world of brand and marketing and anything you want to talk about. So with that in mind, do you want to kick us off? What's top of mind, front of mind for you at the moment?
Well, I've got three things. This morning when I woke up, I was thinking, right, I'm on the show and I want to talk about three things. And I wanted, the best thing to do normally is talk about things that are very true to me at the moment or things that are happening in my world, in my life. And I've had a really, really interesting few weeks because we picked up some new clients over the last few months. And pretty much every single new job that I do now, I bolt on brand strategy at the beginning, whether it be an hour or 8 sessions at 3 hours or whatever it is, but whatever they need. And I do it because those sessions at the beginning, those conversations, asking meaningful questions and really getting into the heart of who they are and what they want and ultimately what they need is a really great way of making sure that I can give them the right product and the right piece of content or whatever it is they're looking for, whether it be a campaign. By having brand strategy sessions at the beginning, I get to really get to know them and work with them closely, and it's deep work. So over the last 3 to 4 weeks, I've probably done now 7 or 8 sessions with different clients. So just to give you an insight of the type of clients I'm working with at the moment, I'm currently working with a cathedral, which is interesting work. Yeah. I'm working with a group of scientists that work within universities and with organizations. Mm-hmm. I'm working with a startup app. Who else have we got on at the moment? I'm working with, a couple of universities.
Yeah.
But the main one I want to talk about is I'm actually doing brand strategy now with other agencies. And this has been an absolute eye-opener, because often you don't get to look inside another agency. You don't get to find out much about them. So by doing brand strategy for other agencies, that exploration is not only being interesting to find out about them, but it's really put a spotlight on my agency and the work that we do. And it's made me really think about this type of work, and it's really uncovered some amazing things.
So to clarify, you're doing brand strategy for the agency, not for the agency's clients, right? For Correct. The agency.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which was at the beginning when we had this conversation, there was a bit of like a showdown. Is it a showdown? A hoedown, sorry. Like looking at each other thinking, is this a good idea? I'm giving away my...
Secrets.
Giving my secrets in a way, yeah. My tactics, my strategy to another agency. But they're opening their doors to me by telling me everything. Finances, strategy, targets, everything. So it's a bit like, whoa, is this a good idea? But we kind of explored it. We thought, you know what? We're not really direct competition. We're at different clients with different, completely different sizes. They're loads bigger than my agency. And we've kind of felt like, yeah, there's definitely a way that we can help each other here. So we signed NDAs and we jumped in and did it. And we're a few sessions deep now. So the three things that came out of this, right? And this is not just them. This is the three things that came out of the brand strategy that I'm doing with all these other organizations. So the other one that wasn't coming to my mind was it's an arts organization who was setting up an e-commerce platform for short courses. That was the one I couldn't think of. That's the other one that we've been working with. So, three things. First thing I want to talk about is customer journeys, because I've learned a lot about customer journeys, offline and online. The third thing is onboarding. So how we onboard anyone into our business, not new customers, I mean everyone. And the third thing is about relationships. So in terms of the customer journeys, what I've learned at the moment, and this is B2B, okay, in the B2B arena with customer journeys, there is multiple personas that you work with online and offline through the whole customer journey. So often when we're doing marketing, we create a profile, a segmentation, an avatar, whatever you want to call it, of our customer, okay? And what we've actually do, we actually do it wrong. We actually need to build our funnel and our kind of customer journey mapping around multiple personas. And then within that multiple personas, multiple decision-making factors along that whole journey. And although that's more complicated, actually, it's really, really interesting to understand what people want and what people need within a company structure, right to the point where they put their hand in the pocket, and it goes up and down the management chain and they want different things.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been studying.
So that's really interesting, right? Because point A is me and Steve have got a background in that type of work anyway. And B, I've done some recently as well. So like when I do customer journey work now, right, I make it the journey circular, not linear, right? And the points of engagement, so the personas, the trigger points, the decision-making journeys, orbit the brand, right? Mm. And go in center, so it's circular now. Because I think the world of business and buyer behavior has changed so much that you need something more adaptable and align a straight line or a linear funnel that has one direction, right, it's just too stiff, right? It's too old school. It doesn't kind of work. So I like a circular one because you can move bits around, you can move value propositions, you can move products, services, people, product market fit, problem solutions, and if whatever the value exchange is in that customer journey.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
As you said, sorry, Johnny, go ahead.
No, you go, mate.
It's as Tim said, it's very hard to actually get a customer journey into a circular model because it means that it's got to come back to the beginning at some point. But I understand where you're coming from in the point that actually it's a pulse more than anything. There are different people in different peripheries that want different questions answered, as you'll all attest to. You're not selling to one person, you're selling to four or five, but four of them you might not ever meet.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. So how do you fulfill all their questions? How do you fulfill all those marketing journeys without ever meeting somebody in a B2B environment?
That's a very, very good question. And that's what I've been working out. So this comes back to decision-making factors, I think, about what people want and need. Okay. So, and you might disagree with this, but I've narrowed it down to four things that people want, or people, the factors that will make a decision go either way. And it's four things. The first thing is the product. So it's the product itself. Is it what they're looking for? You then often look at the quality and craftsmanship of what you offer.
Okay. So this is the customer, right? The end
customer. This is any type of custom. This is, right, so customer is a tricky one in B2B because in a business,
the end customers,
because because there's not one person that actually makes decision. It's a decision chain. And actually across that chain, they've all got different variables of a tick box of what they want.
Yep.
And some of it's personal, some of it's more brand-based, and some of it's more business-based. So this is what you've got to figure out along this journey. So the four things is product first. Is it the right product? Is it what they're looking for? Is it a quality product? Is the craftsmanship there? You know, and then that's that area there. The second thing is solution. Does it solve the problem of what you're looking for? Okay. So, you know, is it innovative? Does it solve the problem? Whatever that is, whatever the value proposition is, does it solve that? The third thing is story. And now this is the thing that people either don't do or don't believe in. And what I've been having with the strategy sessions, the amount of people that just say, no, we don't need to do that. Either one, because they don't think it's important, or two, oh, my customer doesn't care about that. And that's where a lot of people are wrong. And story is complex. A story is about the history, the validation, the heritage. It can be all about the purpose, the values. Story's huge. Yeah. And that's the one thing that lets so many businesses down.
Let me just bolt into yours, tell you my version of the decision-making factors, right? So I have a similar model. They're different than yours.
There is a fourth, by the way. It's cost, by the way. It's just the cost.
Okay.
That's the fourth
one. Well, cost should be in it, right?
Yeah.
So when I do work with B2B people, this is just to add depth and cause you to carry on thinking, right? I think B2B people, like, as in I'm talking to my clients now, so they're the decision-making factors for my client, not their end customer, right? Or money, market, and exposure, right? So my clients either want to know how, what stories I can tell, right, that prove I can increase profit or revenue or reduce costs, right? They want to know if I can increase market share or reduce time to market through what I do, or they want to increase retention. So that's lifetime value of customer or staff and culture now, which is quite a big thing, or reduce risk, like stop them losing something, right? Stop them having to make trade-offs because they've not thought everything through. And they're the factors that for B2B that I use, right? Money, market, and exposure. And do they want to add to or reduce these things?
Yeah. Okay.
It's interesting.
So back to your question about saying about the customer. So, let's just make a theoretical business. We can do it from an agency point of view, because that's what we all know really, really well. So let's look at a customer journey for an agency, right? Let's look at it's outbound, okay? Outbound from them, inbound to us, okay? So they need a new website, okay? It's just an example. So one thing that most people, unless they have someone in mind or someone they know, which will probably be one person they'll contact or a couple, they'll normally search on Google. That's kind of the normal thing, the way of doing it. They'll search on Google. They might look for someone else, but they'll look for agencies. And they will normally choose 3 to 6 agencies that they'll want to have a look at. The first person that's going to do that isn't leadership. It's somewhere down the chain. So leadership or say marketing director will say, this is what we want, this is what we're going to do. They'll agree on it. And then someone will do that work, okay? So it starts off with visibility. So customer one, or say checkpoint one, is visibility. So that's, they're looking for people. And that will normally be marketing manager to sort of maybe down to intern level, but normally about marketing manager, officer, something like that. So they'll go out looking for them. So the first thing that they'll look at, all they're looking for is quality of work, okay? So that's product. They're looking at product. Do you make websites? Yes. Are they any good? They're all right. You're on the list. You get the tender sent to you, okay? And then the handful of people that they know, their mates of mates, they'll get it. So let's say they send it out to 10 people. You then send in your expression of interest, or is it directly goes to proposal stage and you send in your proposal, or it might be a meeting, okay? Normally at that point then, it goes to their line manager. Okay, so that's marketing manager, marketing director level, okay? What are they looking for? They're not looking at quality so much at this point, because that person's already done that. So what they're looking for at this point is solution. Do you offer the solution? Can the website that you make be the right mirror, the right spec of what we want? So they're looking for solution, right? So then you go in there, you pitch your idea, whatever, and then they're going to narrow it down to the final three normally. They might pick one, but it's normally down to the final three. That's when it goes right to the top. And when it goes right to the top, what are they looking for? Now, there is a fifth one, you know, okay? The fifth one is ego. Because sometimes people want to work with agencies because it's like a Gucci handbag. Hey, I'm working with Tim Elliott, the marketing manager. Oh, really? You're working with Tim Elliott? Yeah, yeah. And they want the Gucci handbag. Sorry, Tim, you're a Gucci handbag now.
That's right.
Okay. Now, what they might do is right-hand operational director, finance directors looking at cost. Now, normally at that point, they've already got a budget, but they want to know all the additional costs that come with an agency, because obviously there are always additional costs. Mm-hmm. And then the decision-making process happens, okay? The other decision-making process at that point is story, okay? So they want to know, who are these people? Let's do some due dil on that point. Let's find out a bit more about them. So what they often do is they go to your website and they'll go to your about page and they'll want to know, who are these people? Who's Tim Elliott? Who's Steve and Rick? Let's find out a bit more about them. And then they want to know a little bit more what's behind the brand. Now, that is where people let themselves down, because they don't have anything about them beyond I sell a product and they're an invisible brand. Yeah. And that's why brands or businesses need to be show much more about the story of who they are, yeah, and visibility of what's important to them beyond making the thing and making money.
So I'm interested in Steve's point of view here, because out of us two, even though Steve's agency background, Steve has been predominantly client side.
Yeah, I'm predominantly client side, and I would say 99% of my career has been B2B rather than B2C. B2C is what I dabble in. And I've also been in a lot of organizations that have very big decision trees involved. And Johnny, you've just about nailed it. The only bit for me that is missing is when it goes up that value chain every time, actually that group gets wider and wider. So it won't just be if when a proposal goes in, for example, it won't just be one person reading that proposal. It will go to four or five people from different departments or in different places to read that, who will have no final say in it, but they're looking for people to give their viewpoint on what that agency is. And a lot of the time...
Trusted advice.
Yes, it's massively trusted advice, but it's also a bit more than that. It's company buy-in without people realising. Mm. So you're going to four or five people, here you go, have a look at this. And then people are going, oh, well, that looks really good, or that doesn't look very good. At that point, you know what departments or what other areas of the business have got to buy into the concept that you're trying to put forward, if it's a new website or not.
And it's really about how you make people feel, whether it be their like facts, figures, numbers, or emotional storytelling.
Yeah,
this is where the difficulty is. So what you have to do, you've got to look at it like a checklist. So your company, you map out your customer journey, who's in the decision-making process, and you've got to kind of estimate or guess what do they want. And you've got to be something for everyone. So it's almost like a tick box, like one, are we showing the craftsmanship of our product very early doors in terms of what we offer? So yes. Do we show solutions and benefits? Yes, we do. Yeah. Do we show technical information? Yes, we do. Do we break down our costings? Yeah. Do we show all our legalities and things like that? So it's literally you go, yeah, we do this, we do this, we do this, this.
Yeah.
And once you've got all that, do we present it in a beautiful way that makes people feel a certain way? And I think most companies, no matter what they do, they let themselves down there. Dealing with like the cathedral and dealing with an online e-learning organization, the process is still the same. Although sometimes it's much simpler because it's just one person who's making a decision, but sometimes there's more people. But that's why the B2B is so fascinating.
Yeah.
Because really, when you get that right, it's big ticket stuff. You know, this agency that I'm working with, their minimum order for what they do is £20,000.
Yeah.
That's the minimum order. And obviously they win, you know, 10, 20 of them a month. So that's why this is so important. And I've already noticed in what they do, the gaps of where they're not doing certain things. And I'm saying to them, look, you've got to be that final three proposals. You've got to get in that final three. There's some things that are out of your control there in terms of the MD or whoever's making the decision. There's some things that you can't control, but you need to make sure that you can influence all the things that you can control and the certain areas that they were missing. And it's made me learn about my agency massively. It's made me quite confident that the way that we pitch work and present, like do proposals and go along that chain, we've been really, really good in that. The thing that lets us down, I suppose, is the size of our organization. So, you know, we can rub shoulders with the big agencies. It's only until they do their due deal and find out that we're just a small agency that in the past has let us down. But I can't control that.
No.
You can only control the controllable, right? Which is a phrase from cycling, as per our discussion pre-recording. But I do a lot of commercial storytelling work, it's called, right? So it's for a business purpose. How do you tell that story? And part of that is, again, echoes exactly what you said, Johnny, is like you need to be able to communicate with busy, macro thinking, big picture CEO people, right? So you need to get the big idea about this choice over to them clearly, that they go, okay, I understand it. Here are my questions, right? Because they don't need all the reams of information, but there will be at some point somebody who's got to make that decision work, right? The operational people, the detail people, and they don't need the big idea. They need a flipping manual with an appendix of how exactly it's going to work day by day, step by step, because they're in charge of that, right? And then because you're making a change within the organization, there's also a set of people, let's say the employees or the middle managers, right? The ones who have got to communicate this change to people, who need reassuring that change is all right, it's going to be better. Do you know what I mean? Like they're worried about what will this change mean for me? How will it affect my work? And they need reassuring emotionally. So you need the big idea, right? The big, clear proposition, the thing at the heart of it, right? You said heart earlier on, and I use that analogy, right? What's the heart of this story you're telling, right? What's the thing at the middle that needs to be super clear? Then a detailed bit on how the flipping hell does it work?
Yeah.
How, what is going to happen to me? How does it work? And then, right, the story about it will be all right, the painting the picture of what it will be like once this piece of work is done, when this change is underway, once we've got this new piece of kit in, like, what will it be like? Paint a picture of a world improved with problems solved, with better traffic or whatever it is, right?
Yeah. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it, is trying to present that in a creative way. Sorry, Steve, you go.
It's hard to present it in a creative way, but I think what you've got to do, you know, from a teaching and learning background, you know, from our sins, it's all about getting everybody and every stakeholder into the same place to understand the same thing. So it's about everybody coming together to understand what that heart piece is. So I've done 4 or 5 rebrands, and I'm talking full-on rebrands into new values, new company products, services, everything. The last one was last year. Well, it accumulated last year, and it was nearly £1 million spend. But the first thing that we did was have a story workshop with an outside person coming in to run that story workshop, so we all agreed on the new purpose of what the company was for.
You see, that's really good. Like, it reminds me of a quote, right? That I can't remember who the quote is by, so sorry, internet fact-checking people. But it's, people don't take action on what you tell them, on the information they've got. They take action on what they understand.
Yeah.
Right? And it's that...
100%.
Everybody in that value chain, in that journey, in those personas, whatever you say, right, needs to at least understand everything that's going on. It might not directly affect them, so they might not need to be in the decision part, but they need to understand what's happening and why it's happening, right? They need, and the best way to get that to stick is some kind of narrative, some kind of story, some kind of resonant behavior, which is why, Steve, you get story people in at the beginning, and Johnny, why you make sure the brand strategy is right.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
Yeah, that exploration at the beginning is so essential now. And you know what's quite interesting now is that brand strategy now over Zoom brings other things into the mix, you know, because Tim, we spoke very early on about what was happening in businesses, yeah, and how businesses were organizing, and they were rapid organizing because they had to be organized because we're all sat in our bedrooms and dining rooms and kitchens trying to do our job. And the only way to do that is be super organized. So when developing someone's brand, whether it be a new brand or their existing brand, I'm having these really interesting Zoom conversations with multiple people. It could be 3 people, it could be up to 15, 20 people on these calls. International as well. So we've got people from all around the world jumping onto these calls. And this kind of almost segues a little bit into what I'm, my second thing.
Okay.
I won't cut to it just yet, but is that you, because you have to be super organized and do this, you get to learn about people really, really well. And also, because there's no hierarchy on Zoom, is there? It's like, it's just a bunch of little squares. There's no one walking in there with ego. There's no one walking in there that, like, in terms of hierarchy. Sometimes I have Zoom calls with a team of people. I don't know who's the boss. I don't know who everyone is, because people are sort of joining in, and, oh yeah, Dave's about to join now. He's coming in from wherever. And, oh yeah, Tony's with us now. I don't know who anyone is. So everyone's on an even playing ground. And I like that, because you just get to talk as humans. I mean, and that's been interesting.
We've brought that up, like the skill of facilitation, like in season 1, we were on about as like what makes an effective person now is that ability to facilitate. But it absolutely has equaled out the playing field, right? Because I remember, like last summer, when we had a lockdown break briefly in the UK, we had, I did an in-person piece of work about 5 miles away from my house, right, with 4 leaders, so small company. right? And in that, like, compared to the workshops on Zoom I've done with them, where everyone's confident at speaking up, when I asked a question to the group in that real life situation, they all looked at the boss, like, and they were like the leaders, right? The grown adults, like senior people. Right, and they were all like, I was like, I didn't ask Nick. I asked everybody. Right? I want everybody's opinion. But on Zoom, it's easier to do that because I don't know if it's...
I think it's probably a time thing as well, though, Tim. I mean, if you ran that workshop again now, after a year of lockdowns and a year of working in your home environment and a year of working in Zoom, if you had that workshop now, would the same thing still happen? I don't know. I think there's been almost a...
I mean, I've evolved. Shift.
Yeah, I think people have grown into themselves a little bit more over the last year. Whereas before, they'd have been in that whole thing of, oh, 2 months ago, I wouldn't dare say this in front of my boss. But now a year later, they might go, well, I've worked from home for a year. I'm now myself again.
And you've had...
You can't hit me from there.
Yeah.
to build a successful organisation, especially in this time, right, you need trust, empathy and accountability to be forefront, right? Yeah. Which equal levels that playing field again, I
It's
think.
Much harder to be a full-on wanker when you're shouting from your kitchen. You can't do it because it's like, oh, you're shouting me at Zoom from your kitchen. You know, in a room... You know, as humans, we can control the feeling, the environment and what goes on. And, you know, people can use mind games and their Jedi mind tricks in business. You can't do that over Zoom. And I love it because it just strips it all back. And this kind of goes into my next thing. I'm going to go into it. It's all about onboarding. And when I mention onboarding, this is the first situation, encounter, moment that people have with you and your business, right? This doesn't necessarily have to be a new customer either. It can just be anyone, right? And I find now, and I'd be interested to know what you guys think, that you first impressions count massively. They do for me now. Like, I don't suffer fools gladly anymore. Like, I'm a busy, busy person, and I've got to work very quickly and very efficiently, but I've got to do it in a way that makes people feel good. Like, I truly believe that we win work at Seed because we make people feel a certain way, and we do it by being calm, composed. We're always being our best self all the time. And some people just can't do it. So just as an example, I'm not going to mention the organization, but I had it was a strategy session, and one in particular person, and I'll say maybe two, but one in particular was so rude, and I don't think they realized how rude they were being. They yawned throughout the whole session. They disagreed not with just me, with everyone, and they just came off the back of it looking rubbish. And I came away thinking, I don't want to work with you. And I don't want to work with your business. And I feel sorry for anyone that works with you. And I'm just going to do the work that I've got to do. I'm going to deliver it. And you're going to have to do something now that's going to change my mind. And that was just from one Zoom call.
So it is possible to be full-on wanker on Zoom.
But you can't get away with it. You can't get away with it. Well, not with me anyway. And I think it's good. We should be our best selves all the time. And we should... We should be very mindful of the way we act in front of new people. Like, you don't know how that relationship's going to blossom. You don't know what's going to come off the back of it. You have to be your best self all the time. And I know we have bad days and we have good days, but you've got to, and Natalie's amazing for this, the other director. She makes me good all the time. She teaches me how to stay calm. She teaches me to be empathetic. She teaches me to think about people in a different way and to try and be my best self. And being healthy helps with that.
Yeah. And I think there's two things that come out into that. That behind that, we're on Zoom, people on the podcast, right? And behind each of us is a door. And we don't know what's happening behind that door. Like really, we've got a fair impression what's happening behind Steve's door, but we don't mention it. But otherwise, there's the second point, a more serious point, is that there's been a phrase, I've seen T-shirts made of it, and I think billboards and adverts, where the word humankind has been up, yeah. right? But emphasis on the two parts, human and kind. And that it echoes what you said, Johnny, right? Like, be empathetic, be like, just be human and be yourself. Because I think that, like, I've certainly learned to be more of myself than the role I played before.
Zoom has allowed us to be more human. And this is counterintuitive, isn't it? Because you think meeting somebody face-to-face, you'd see the real them compared to over a Zoom call. But when if you remember walking into offices to do a pitch or any of that, that's professional person at work. So it's often a different facade that person's got. As soon as they walk through the doors of their office, they're a different person. Whereas now we're letting people into our lives, into our homes. You know, I can see your two homes. Mine's much more beautiful than yours, Tim.
It is. But
what I'm saying is your personality starts to become on show just by looking at a background, not just through how you're interacting.
Yeah.
And that people forget that. So when I'm first introduced into a new person on Zoom or have a conversation, the first 5 minutes I have no agenda at all. I just want to ask them how the day was, what they're hoping to get from it, what do they like to talk about, what's their interest, those types of things, because it puts you on that level playing field. But if you was in a professional setting, you would never have done that. You'd never do that type of introduction.
And like the key with it is like being your best self. So this one person in question came onto the call, didn't even look up at the camera, was just looking down the whole time, didn't want to be in the call, obviously had been roped into it, didn't want to do it, didn't ask any questions. So I was thinking, this person's maybe had a rough day, like I'll do that, but was just kind of rude. And I start to think, maybe that's just the way they are. Like, everyone's different. It takes all sorts of the world to go around. I get that. But but the thing is, they could have just sat up, they could have smiled, listened. And to be your best self all the time isn't just something you just do. It's something you've got to really work at. You know, I sometimes go into meetings, I've said the kids have been up all night and I'm tired. I still have to go and be my best self. And I'm not saying that I'm acting, I'm just finding some inner strength to smile, listen, and just try and let them know who I are, the best person I can be. Yeah. And you know what? One thing I'm learning now about business is that there are many ways to make money. There's many ways. Everyone thinks there's a route A to B to make money. Say you sell product or you sell service or whatever it is. Actually, there's so many avenues and opportunities for people to talk about you, to meet new people, to do things. And if you can just be your best self and be a nice person all the time, the amount of opportunities that will be presented to you than being an asshole. And, you know, that company I'm talking about, sorry, swearing, that company, I bet they don't even realise how much work they're losing from behaving like that, because I can get people work. I know a lot of people that I refer people every single day. Oh, you want to speak to Steve about that? Oh, you need to speak to Tim about that, or whoever it is. I'm not going to refer them now. Mm. And, like, you know, maybe they've had a bad day, but I just don't think there's room for a bad day at the office anymore.
But there's sayings, you know, and it comes back down to storytelling again, but, you know, there are sayings that stay with us throughout life and have been passed down through generation after generation and generation. And one of those lines is always, nice guys always win. Mm. But it's true. They do. The nice guys are remembered. The nice guys are the ones who are going to get further work. The nice guys are going to be ones who are referred. Because if they're good at what they do and they come across pleasant and they try and do what they want, why wouldn't you want to work with somebody like that?
Yeah. And for, like, you only get what... There's loads of phrases around brand, right, about brand reputation that link to first impressions, isn't there? Like, it takes 10 years to build an amazing brand and 10 seconds to lose it, et cetera, right? Do you know what I mean? All those contrasting phrases that happen that say, but it's like it's super true. I think what you describe probably segues into your third point, not that we have to do it at this point, but that's about building relationships, right? Being trusted, being known, like, and trusted. How old is known, like, and trusted?
It's the oldest form of marketing.
Like,
it's old. Like when you, if you were selling 1,000 years ago, if you were selling potatoes to your local village, you're probably more likely to buy the potatoes off the guy
that you know
you got along with. Yeah. And even if it was like really moldy, they'd have to be pretty moldy for you not to buy them. But, you know, even if it was like slightly smaller Jersey Royals, you know, I don't really like his potatoes, but David, he's all right in a yard. I'll still go to him because Tony, I don't think his name was Tony. Yeah. Let's say his name was Cuthbert. I don't know. You wouldn't buy his potatoes because you didn't like him.
Man,
you wouldn't put money in his pocket.
Cuthbert's potatoes are rough. So I think they all know that.
But no, do you know what? This does segue into the next bit because it's about nurturing relationships. And I actually believe that we win work at Seed, and lots of people, and including yourself, you two guys, that people win work for just being a nice person. Okay, I've just said that a minute ago. But and the key is here, and this is what I've learned, and I think COVID's taught me this. You need to try and approach every situation with love and compassion. Right. So in every situation, like say you've got to write an email or you've got to have a difficult conversation or someone's absolutely rubbed you up the wrong way, just think to yourself first, take a deep breath. Okay. Have a cup of tea and have something to eat is normally the first thing to do. Glass of water. Then think to yourself, how do I approach this with love and compassion? And the moment you even just say those words in your head, you actually change the way that you think. So I've had some difficult situations I don't think they're going to watch it. I've had some difficult situations with my next door neighbors, okay, about things that are going on, right? They can't hear me. So
we've only got 8 listeners and they're not in it, so it's fine.
Yeah. I'd be surprised if they are. And like, I was thinking to myself, how do I approach this with love and compassion? And you change the way, and you start to be empathetic. You start to think, well why are they doing that? And so on. And then you start to understand why they might behave like that. And the point that if you can do that in every situation, actually you can just come off better. You know, you can look at things with a new lens, and then your decision-making process will come from a different angle. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way of nurturing relationships, because everyone that we work with, we get along with most people, even though that we're very, very different, because we try and approach everything that we do. We always try and do a good job, but, you know, love and compassion. And I think that's where be useful, be kind really comes from, is being useful is doing a good job, showing up, working hard, craftsmanship is a big thing, and then being kind is approaching things with love, being empathetic, listening, being your best self. You know, that is the key. And I truly believe if you can do that in business, you will open up so many new doors and so many more opportunities.
But just going on that love and compassion thing, you know, one reason to do it, and you should always do it, and it's something I wholeheartedly believe in, you may end up with the same outcome as if you'd walked in without love and compassion. But if you go in with love and compassion and walk away and it still hasn't worked, you can walk away with your head held high.
Yeah, I think
so. And actually, you can walk away going, you know, you tried to do the best that you could. And actually, you might not have been good enough, but it doesn't matter because you exerted everything that you could do. And that is all that love and compassion thought process. It's all around the empathy piece. Mm. And that's, people love somebody who's tried their best.
Yeah. And you know what? With that, a lot of people out there think it's a weakness when actually it's a strength.
It's one of the biggest strengths.
Yeah. And really, I think if you can look at things that way, it takes a lot of courage to think like that. And it and you remove ego. And if you can remove ego, I think you become much more fluid in the way that you navigate through things, and you don't get caught up in toxic environments. You don't get caught up in negativity. You don't get caught up in argument. If you can remove ego, then actually life becomes a lot easier.
This is where it gets really interesting, because what is marketing is a servicing industry. It's a service industry. So not having love and compassion means you're never going to deliver the best service.
Mm. But there's a bunch of marketing people who and agencies and freelancers and consultants and that compete on compete on ego, compete on perceived size and quality of personal brand, maybe?
Think about it, across the world, I should think 90% of marketing companies have worked with Coca-Cola, if you look at their website, because everybody's got the Coca-Cola logo on it. Look at the campaign we did for these. It's like, no. That's an ego thing, but it doesn't change the love and compassion thing.
But it comes down to that. Like, they're all super interlinked, right? They're like, taking the time to really understand your customer, right? To really understand them, not just take the information they give you in a brief, bearing in mind the clients are fundamentally not brief makers as a rule. It's a whole different podcast. But you know, taking the time to ask the right questions. I think, Johnny, you said in the beginning, like, asking meaningful questions, right? Meaningful questions, not just questions like, when do you need this by? Or what's your budget? Right. Sure. You need to know that, but they're operational questions, right? They're the thing. Like, what are the meaningful questions you've got to ask? What are the questions that matter? What are the questions you can ask that the answers will change the game for that client and for the piece of work you're about to do? Right. What's that meaningful question?
Well, the big question is, what do you want?
Yeah.
What do you want? That's like that. That is the ultimate question. And like, what do you want? Not what do you want as a group? What do you want? And that gets the best answers.
So I've got, actually, Johnny, you just reminded me of a thing I'm going to ask you. Right? I was we've done similar ballpark type of work for type of organisations for a bit, right? And I've for brand strategies. Sort of work that I've done, as strategy related work, let's say, right? Before I've worked with organizations, right? This is before, as in 2019, so not ancient history, but before I've worked with organizations, with groups, with teams as a whole, right? And I'm very human centered in the way I do stuff anyway. So I try and give their brand or their organization a personality, right? So it's still the same sort of thing. But now, like, literally the last 6 to 8 months, like, all that piece of work that I'm still doing, right, is now done on an individual level, right? So first you change and understand the leader, like, on its own, like, just them. On her own, right? On their own as an individual. And then you do that for everybody involved, like properly involved, not everybody, but fundamentally involved in this change or transition success, right? At an individual level, because these people are now working together alone, right? They're working, they're not on Zoom 7 hours a day, right? Not sitting in the office together. They're working. They may be on Zoom together an hour, maybe two a day, but the rest of the time they're working alone, but together. Yeah. Right. And I think change or strategy or alignment now, I mean, just in my work, this is a personal story, right? Is about changing the individual's perspective, change their thinking culture, right? And then figuring out, and then by the end of that piece of work, you've changed the organization's feeling and position and brand and story, right? By understanding the individual. But I've personally never did that before, right? Yeah. Personally, it just wasn't the way the work was delivered. It just wasn't, right? You did leadership meetings, leadership groups and team branding and stuff. I don't know where I was going with that point. It just felt like the right point to say it.
Well, you know what? What you mean by there is like, you know, how strategy has changed. Strategy has changed a lot in the last 12 months of how we facilitate strategy. And it's so different now doing it than doing it in a boardroom or a room more than 12 months ago. You know, very different now to how we do it now. And I think with now it's there's some sort of therapy in this, you know. There is a little bit of therapy. Business therapy is often what happens, because when you ask those big questions, you get big answers. And with big answers, some people like it and some people don't. What's amazing now, getting a CEO in a room or a Zoom call and saying to them, like, why do you do what you do? Or what do you want? Or what type of people don't like working with you? And asking those type of questions and just seeing what they do and how they react to these type of questions is amazing. And I love facilitating that type of work, because it's like being in the army. You've got to strip it all back at boot camp to rebuild. And it's interesting, those first few hours you get to get a handle of whether this company has got the opportunity or the potential to recover from this and become amazing, or there's no chance and these guys are in big trouble.
I see this whole brand, I find it really frustrating when people, you know, quite often go, oh, we need a rebrand, and have just got one thing in mind, you know, because anything, when you start looking at brand and rebrand and organizational culture, they're so intrinsic to each other that actually brand becomes the gateway to business transformation.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. People don't understand that brand is business transformation.
Brand is
set your journey.
Yeah. Do you know what? Like, if you think of a rebrand, right? So let's think of a couple that's gone to, let's look at relationships. Let's look at a couple who are having relationship problems, and they think that dressing up as a fireman and a nurse is going to sort out their business.
That's not personal problems on the podcast, dude.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you know?
I told you that in secrecy.
That's what's in behind your door. It's loads of truncheons. I've seen them. But that's what a rebrand is. A lot of businesses think, oh, I know, we've got loads of problems. Our customers don't really connect with us. We've got a massive churn in our organization. We're losing our team. I know, let's have a rebrand. Our logo looks a bit old and fusty. Let's have a rebrand. And what they're trying to say is, basically, we need to find out in the heart of our organization what's going wrong. And actually, it's probably sometimes it's not a rebrand they need. It's actually just having a very deep and meaningful conversation about where the problems are coming from, and going from there. And some of my work is about that, you know. And I haven't purposely become this person. It's kind of just people open their doors to me and allow me to talk about their businesses and their brands. And while I ask these questions, I watch it unravel in front of me, and it is really interesting.
Wait. Like, I've got an interesting story. Like, this week I've had that very thing, right? I had a final meeting with the CEO of an organization, right, where I've been working with their leaders, not the top guy, who has struggled with alignment to vision and mission and brand purpose and stuff like that, right? So I've been working with the leaders, figuring out what the situation is actually, because he's so far removed from the day to day, because he's the top, right? That he can see the big problems, but don't know, you know, the nitty gritty behind it. And I reported back to them, and so I've spoken to the 11 leaders, right? The 11 leaders who manage 1,200 people between them, right? I've spoken to them, and this is the consensus of what they're saying the issues are. And he was like, well, they've never said that to me. I don't believe it. And I was like, why would they say that to you? Like, you don't, even if you ask them, they're going to tell you it's all shiny because you're the boss. Like, they're not, you know, they admitted it to me because I said this is a one-to-one user research problem that I'm only going to publish on my podcast. And it's like, it's a, but it's that, right? People admit it to people like us. Like, all three of us have those difficult conversations with our clients, right? It's our job to have difficult conversations with our clients, because nobody employed by them will have the difficult conversation. Sweeping generalization. Sorry if you're that guy.
No, but you're right. They won't. They often don't have those conversations, and often it's not talked about because there's an element of fear. It's a fearful culture that people will feel like they'll get their they'll get sacked if they do it. People just think a lot of time, like depending on what age they are, that some people just think it's the norm. Like Natalie, she worked in two or three businesses before she moved into the creative industry. She worked in one sector in particular, and she just thought it was normal to be horrible to each other. She thought it was normal to wake up every morning and dread going to work. You know, she thought it was normal for people to patronize you and talk down to you. And then she came in to work for a nice agency. It was a different agency, not mine. And thought, wow, you can actually go to work and people are nice to you and your boss will make you a cup of tea and listen to you. Like, they didn't know it existed. And I think people, that these organizations, they might be profitable for now, but staff churn and negative culture will eventually rot you from the inside out. It will eventually do it. And you have to get that early. And it does true. It rots from the head. It starts from the top and then it just flows down through the organization.
In the world of work, not to go super macro, but we've got like people now, because a lot of companies, sweeping generalization again, a lot of companies, a lot of industries are now open by force to hiring people not within a 20-mile, 20-minute radius of their office, right? So they can pick the best people for the job. But that is not all the power of the employee. It's in power of the worker, right, of the person. They can go for the job they'd love but can't get to London for 7 a.m. every day because they live in Newark, right? But they're the best person for the job. But that doesn't matter now. It matters. Like 2 days a week, you can do it. 5 days a week, 4 weeks a month, 12 months a year, you can't, you'd like, no. But 2 days a week?
Yeah, I know what I've climatized to the whole video conferencing way of life quite well. I quite like it. Honestly, I want to see you guys, and I do. And we will have a beer at some point. And I do want to be around people. I do love going to like networking events. I do love going to events. You know, Tim, we used to go to quite a few events and stuff like that. And I do miss them. But in terms of working, I quite like working on my own a lot. I get more done. And although there is a benefit of being around an office and being around people, overall, I can get that from being around peers and maybe like one day a week, just like working, hot desking from somewhere or being around people. But I think now the next person I employ, I as long as the time zones are not too crazy, I'm just going to look for talent now. I'm just going to look for talent. And I think a lot of people in my industry like that. Most people that work in offices work in isolation anyway. They've got their headphones on, don't talk to anyone. Most people in my industry love working from home.
What it allows as well, Johnny, I think we've said this before on the podcast, in that whole working culture is there would be people before who wouldn't go for roles at different companies because they're quite introverted in what they are. But this whole through a screen is allowing the introverts to become extroverts at the same time. So I'm a very introverted person. I prefer my own company to others quite often. But actually through Zoom and Teams and what have you, I'm more comfortable that way. So I've done more Teams calls or more chat calls than I've ever done. And I've met more and more new people and my network's expanded further and further just because I can do it with comfort of being in my own home rather than being in a networking room, for example.
It has. And obviously, I suppose on the flip side, that there are people that need that people, don't they?
Yeah, of course.
People are missing the serendipity of conversation around the office, right? I was speaking to, I think, somebody we both know, Ross Davis, this morning from Strafe Creative, he did a rebite, actually. And just asked him how running an agency has been, because he's got an agency with not loads of staff, I think 12, 15, something. Like, so not massive, but staff to manage. He was like, there's people I haven't spoken to in 2 weeks, like, because I'm not involved in the project, but I should really feel how they are, but I can't text them every 12 minutes to go, hey, how are you? Because they think it's about work. There's a whole issue of communication, right? Like, and he's now strategically calendarized open Zoom time. Like, I'm going to be on Zoom with Paddy, the other director, for 3 hours on Tuesday morning. Like, you can come or not come. It's not mandatory. Like, we're just hanging out. You can't talk about work. We're just going to hang out because we don't get to hang out. Do you know what I mean?
I know one agency I know in London, and they've said to all their staff, if you want to work from home for the foreseeable, you can. What we're going to do is we're going to keep the office, but we're going to turn it into a creative hub, right? So that if you want to work there, you can, but we're going to meet up maybe once or twice a week, come down there, have a coffee, have a chat, have a beer, when they can, obviously, and then just use it as a hub. We'll still have meetings down there. We'll do our creative planning there. But once that's done, if you want to go back home, you just work from home. If you don't need to go to the office, you don't go. And they're just going to have it for both. So you've got a bit of both. So for the people that work from home, they can. But the people that need to be around other people and have that social interaction, they've got that opportunity too. And I find that a lot of industries are doing similar things in terms of this blended approach. So we've had this digital migration, digital transformation, what you want to call it, from being very social. And then as we then go further through this year, month by month, we're going to find a fusion of there's some of the things that we're doing now to some of the better things that we did before. So life in 6 months, 12 months is going to be quite different for a lot of people, all of us included.
We had exactly the same conversation with Steve Noss on a previous podcast regarding, work-life balance and all those different things. But you're completely right on that whole. And what we got to is it was two polar opposites. So you were in an office between 9 and 5 for 5 days a week. You're not doing that anymore. You're now at home all the time in front of a computer. And actually, you need the blended middle so you can meet between. Rather than it just being one polar opposite to the other, you need to have that central section where people might feel more comfortable. So you're completely right in that blended approach in between conversation to getting work done, what is the best way for the right person inside their own frame. And I think you're the one, Johnny, who nailed it months ago by saying work-life balance isn't a thing anymore and it's about work integration into your life.
Yeah.
And that when I heard you say that on one of your Instagram things or your LinkedIn ones, it completely blew me away. There's probably one or two things that I remember a year, that I really take away and put it down as a mantra to live to, and work integration was one of those.
And do you know why that's really important? Because, and thank you for saying that, if you're taking on staff, I would really encourage all my staff now to figure out their work-life integration. And for these reasons, one is a lot of people exercise in the day, which is a good thing. If they're exercising, they're healthy. If they're healthy, they've got more energy. If they've got more energy, they tend to be in better spirits. And we're talking about bringing your A game all the time. I feel like by being able to be a bit more flexible within your working day, by not being stressed out with your children and being able to get your kids to school, get them back, exercise, and doing your work whenever you see fit. So I'm doing a lot more work, say now, in the evenings.
Yeah.
I've been doing chipping away a little bit on a Sunday, doing a bit of writing, and on a Saturday sometimes I'll go up and I'll do some editing, but then mixing it around my kids, and actually I feel so much more chilled out. And that's why I'm able, that when I am working, to bring my best self, and my best self is winning me new business and it's allowing me to be more productive. So actually the work-life integration, although I'm taking hours of a 9-to-5 day, and actually weekly I might be working slightly less hours, the hours that I am working, I am performing much higher. Yeah. And that's work-life integration has allowed me to do that.
It's honestly a mantra that everybody should live by.
Yeah.
That I find it really hard to switch on creatively until probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Because in the morning, especially in these times, in the morning, I'm worried about getting the kids homeschooled done. I'm worried about getting the dog walked. I want to go and do a bit of exercise. It's all those things. But then when all that's done, I feel like that chapter's almost closed. I can crack on with things that I need to do. And I've also woken up properly by that point because I've had 40 coffees.
You're actually working from the moment you wake up as well, because you know, you're thinking about things. You're thinking, oh, I might speak to that person about that, or oh, actually, you know what, I'm going to send that email to that person because I think that's, you know, whatever. Yeah, but those spaces where you are walking the dog or you're on the bike, you know, actually those thinking times, that's the best work. Yeah. That is the best work, and okay. I truly believe strategists, which we all are, our best work is done when we're not at work. It's when we're going on a bike, cycling, running, walking the dog, in the shower, meditating. That's when the gold drops in, and that's what I love.
It's funny, if you recount back, both of you, I bet if you both recount back those brilliant ideas that you've had, you've been doing something completely mundane, not actually doing work.
Yeah.
So my best ones usually come when I'm brushing my teeth, for example. Because my brain's completely switched off from every thought process, and it goes, oh, here you go, Steve, this is what you need from a strategy. Yeah. You go, oh, that makes sense now, that's great. And you can go away and be creative around it.
And when we were rushing around, getting trains, driving up and down the M1 like Tim, you was doing, you know, and rushing around, trying to get to pointless meetings, speaking to pointless people, you know, that wasn't productive. We just no. It was just running around all the time. I feel like I'm doing some of my best work now, whether it be writing, you know, making, like I wasn't really making hardly any videos prior to COVID. I was trying to bang out the odd one here and there when I got a free moment when the kids weren't running around. But now I've got these times to make really good, meaningful content.
Part of the reason you're here, because we both consume your content. You're not just here because we know you, like, do you know what I mean? But it's good.
Oh, cheers. That means a lot. Thank you.
It's good, mate. It's good.
Especially the new one you're doing on Instagram is at 3:30 on Friday afternoon. It's brilliant.
Yeah, thank you. Brilliant. Yeah. We'll have to get you on the show, mate. We'll definitely get you on. Yeah, do you know what? I'm enjoying the live stuff. It's quite nerve-wracking live. I don't know how much live you guys do, but you know, it's more like I can stand in front of 100 people at a lecture and feel all right. But doing a live video in front of 2 people makes me really nervous. It's really weird. I don't know what it is, but I'm enjoying it. I just think I find the technology fascinating that we can. You know, I'm speaking to people in Nigeria, and I'm speaking to another guy in Nigeria soon, and I just sound like we're talking real time in front of everyone in the world. Recording this, and I'm going to repurpose it on all my platforms. Yeah. I just find it fascinating. It's amazing.
In 35 minutes after we record this, I've got a meeting with 2 leaders in Virginia in the States. Like in 35 minutes.
Yeah, wicked.
Like on, do you know what I mean? Like, and I've never been. I've been to America once, but I was 9, so it doesn't really count. But do you know what? Like, I don't know. I've never, like. Not to open this bottle of tricks, it may be another episode and conversation altogether, but like the ability to work anywhere forever and not meet your clients, right? There was a time when you had to meet your clients. You had to go in, shake their hand, meet them. Do you know what I mean? People wouldn't buy remotely, but now that buyer behavior has changed, hasn't it? Not to open that bottle of fish. This bottle of fish, that's a weird phrase.
I like that. I'm fair.
But not to open this bottle of fish at this late in the podcast. But, you know, it's buyer behavior has changed, right? So we as marketing, we as creatives, we as, I don't know, the people
have been there for such a long time, but we've just ignored it though, Tim. That's the thing, you know, especially from that B2B perspective, that whole not actually meeting your customer, doing it all online, even to the point where they don't do video calls, you know, it's been happening through the likes of Facebook and what have you for years, with social media platforms have that bigger customer base, but half of the people are just sat on a beach in California doing it on their phone.
Yeah.
And it's been, you know, Zuckerberg said that years and years ago, and I know he's getting a lot of bad press at the minute, and I agree with a lot of the bad press, but 10 years ago, he said, the world will change. People can work from anywhere in the world from a mobile phone, and it will have as much impact as having a face-to-face meeting. And he's completely right.
And it's all the time you save. Like, you know, do you know what's amazing now? I've just joined health-wise. And health, and I talk about health and work always in the same sentence, and we all do. It's really interesting. But I'm a member of a community. And it's about flow exercises. I've got a problem with my back. And what's amazing, I can be doing my work. And it's like, all right, it's 2 o'clock now. I go down, put my mat down, do my exercises on Zoom, put my laptop back, go straight back upstairs and work in. When I was doing exercise before, I'd have to get my gym stuff, get in the car, drive somewhere, get in there, get in the locker room, blah, 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 and come out there. And I'd lose 2 to 3 hours. So I've just saved 2 hours there by kind of, it's not the same experience, no, but it's still, I still do what I need to do. Same again with meetings. Like I used to drive up and down to London, Manchester, Leeds, every single week, going and pitching, meet. I'd have a 20 minute meeting in Leeds, right? And then drive back and not think anything of it. And now I think, why did I do that? Why was I driving all that way for a 20 minute meeting? I thought, I'm never doing that ever again now.
It's just what everybody else did. So we just conformed and did what everybody else did.
Yeah.
It is crazy that we got so wrapped up in it. And it, you know, like you said, COVID's been bad, but there's been a lot of good things we can learn from it. And we've just got to take that and run with it. Because if we don't, then what a waste of a year and what a waste of people's lives and all those different things. You know, we can do so much better. We can do so much better.
I think that's a strong point to end on, that we can all do so much better. Johnny, have you got any final remarks as a co-host before we layer you with gratitude and platitude?
I would say just to echo what we talked about, and what's been important to me is just bringing your A game. And bringing your A game isn't necessarily about bringing your skills and what, your craft, you know. It's about trying to be your best self all the time, whatever that is. And I truly believe keeping your body, your mind, your emotions and your spirit healthy as much as you can, because it'll help you just go into certain situations and be a better person, and it will help you react. And when you go through difficult conversations or difficult emotions, being your best self will pay dividends, and it will open so many doors for you. So I think that's a thing I've definitely learned over the last few weeks and months.
100%. 100%. On that note, mate, thank you very much for coming on board. I know we've siphoned off your knowledge and gold bombs a few times on this podcast and referred to you. So we appreciate your time, my friend. Let people know where best to get hold of you and find out about Seed and stuff. And I'll obviously put them in the links.
Yeah. So Seed Creativity is the agency, so go on there, have a look now, but come back in, I'm going to say 2 months on the safe side. We're building our new website, which I keep saying to you all the time, don't I? I am building this new website. It's taken a long time, but I'm really proud of it. It's really coming on now. So about April time, come and have a look at our site, Seed Creativity. It's going to look great. But just type in Brand Master Flash on any platform and there'll be something flying around, hopefully. And just check out, you know, the things that I make and do.
Steve, do you want to finish off, my friend?
I just want to say thanks a lot, Johnny. It's been awesome. You're one of those that eventually, you know, when you write a book about stuff, it'll be on the shelf next to the Cinec books.
Yeah, nice. Thank you.
Honestly, I think as Tim alluded to, we've dropped a lot of your knowledge bombs before, and you're getting to that status now. So I can't thank you enough for coming on and co-hosting. We couldn't have asked for anybody better. So we really appreciate it.
Well, hopefully next time we do this, chaps, we'll actually see each other in real life.
Great.
I'll still be on Zoom.
We won't have anything to say to each other, will we? We'll just sat there twiddling our thumbs. But I think we should do a live video / podcast or whatever in a pub back garden this summer.
Yep.
I'm up for it.
For the brief 3-week window we'll have before.
Or on a bike. So me and Tim will be running. Steve will be behind on his bike. We'll have headsets in, lapel mics, and we'll do a live.
That reminds me of the film Run, Fat Boy, Run. I'll be like the guy on the scooter.
Oh, I thought Annika Rice on Challenge Annika. Ask your grandparents.
Anyway. It would just be a lot of heavy breath. It would be so boring, wouldn't it?
Good. Maybe we'll do a different... Maybe that'll be a different thing. But anyway, cool. With that, I think we'll leave it.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
This has been the Brandmaster Flash episode. We hope you've liked it. Leave us a comment.